Before reading God's word, let's ask his help. Lord, take your word, a book that we don't read so often, and teach us what we need to learn this day from it. And this we ask in Christ's name. Amen. Now, I think I'm going to change how I usually do things this morning and do the introduction to the sermon, then read the passage. When Gretchen and I were in Bloomington, Indiana, a couple of weeks ago, while I was speaking at Indiana University, in church, among the different Chinese students from the university whom I met, was a man, I would say, in his early 40s, who was there as an exchange scholar from the University of Beijing, and his field of study was American folklore. Now, that doesn't strike Americans as odd. I mean, we have all kinds of studies of African folklore and so on. But for a Chinese to be doing this is a remarkable departure from Chinese history, because the actual curiosity of one civilization for another has been almost exclusively a Christian concern for the last many centuries. That is, Christian Europe sends out a Marco Polo from Venice to China who comes back and talks about the wonders that he's seen there and things we should learn and imitate. That's very characteristic of Christian European civilization. It is not characteristic of Chinese, Japanese, Indian, or the rest of the world. They've had astonishingly little curiosity about the rest of the world, and if they were curious, there was no point in learning it because theirs was already the best way. Now, we may be aware that Americans have sometimes thought this way, and actually, uncharacteristically, Europeans and Americans from about 1870 to 1920 sort of thought this way about our culture, but it's not really the way the West has thought. We've been very open to other influences and curious about others. So here was this guy from China who's studying American folklore. I really wanted to talk to him. His English wasn't very good, so we couldn't have a whole lot of a conversation. But I thought, I wonder if this is another manifestation of the ongoing Christianization of China. And that is what is going on. Don't be confused about it. There's an ongoing Christianization of China now in process in that country. It won't be stopped. It will triumph. And part of that is suddenly they are interested in other peoples, other places, other cultures, other ways. Why have Christians always been so remarkably open to other cultures? After all, one of the things that you might pick up at Thanksgiving time is what the pilgrims learned from the Indians. Right? The story is not just of evil white man come over and destroy peaceful, nice Native Americans. All right, that's a fairly bad account of what actually happens. One thing that happens is there's an awful lot of borrowing that goes both directions, but we especially borrow an awful lot very quickly from the Indians. If we find something useful, a new crop, a new way of doing things, the pilgrims, the Puritans, just snapped it right up. Why are Christians like this? Well, I think one reason is that we understand that God made all nations and has his purposes for all nations. And you can get that in lots of different places in the Bible. God intended from the beginning with Abraham that through Abraham he would bless all nations of the earth. And crucially, on the day of Pentecost, the gospel is preached in all the other languages. They don't all learn Hebrew. So we've always understood it's our job to be as a Greek to the Greeks, to a Hebrew as the Hebrews, as Paul says in Corinthians, and to be ready to take on the outward trappings of other cultures than what we're used to. Now, the other thing is, if you read the Bible carefully, how many civilizations do you actually come in contact with in the Bible? Well, there's the Egyptian. There's the Canaanite, Phoenician, Carthaginian. It's all the same culture, by the way. All right? You're in close contact with that. There is the Greek, there is the Roman, there is a good bit of the Babylonian, And I'm saying all this because for people who've grown up with the Bible, you're already familiar with a lot of different social customs just as they turn up in the scriptures. And so there's a less of a sense of this is the only right way you have to do things. Now, I'm saying all this is a long introduction to the book of Esther because Esther is Persian. And the Persian is about at the far outer limit of the Bible's acquaintance with other cultures. And boy, is this strange. When you read the book of Esther, if you're paying attention to more than just the main dramatic storyline, you say, these are not our customs. And this is not the way we do things. And I think you'll find if you're listening the way I do, that you're fairly horrified at some of the customs here. It's remarkable that the book makes no judgment about the Persian customs. There's no judgment at all. And I think we've noted that we, as heirs of the Greeks, tend to have, automatically from our schooling, a very negative view of the Persians. They are an oriental despot kind of place trying to smother the wonderful Greek democracies. All right, that's the Greek version. And but when you read the Bible, it's a lot more favorable to the Persians. Nevertheless, I can't help feeling some of the Greek reaction when I read Esther chapter 2, which is what we're going to read now. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, I'll tell you later what these things are and why he was angry, he remembered Vashti, what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan the citadel, into the women's quarters, under the custody of Haggai the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and that beauty preparations be given them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This thing pleased the king, and he did so. In Shushan the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish of Benjamin. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Zephaniah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it was, when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace, into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor. So he readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance. Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. And every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. Each young woman's turn came to go in to King Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months' preparation, according to the regulations for the women, for thus were the days of their preparation apportioned. 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. Thus prepared, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters to the king's palace. In the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of Shaashgaz, the king's eunuch, who kept the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. Now when the turn came from Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, to go into the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants. And he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. When virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on the gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. In going through the Bible from Genesis on, and following the theme of marriage in each book of the Bible, I thought of just skipping Esther, and then I thought, but somebody would say to me, there is a marriage in Esther. And actually, the marriage in Esther is at the heart of it. But it's a marriage unlike any that we have any experience with or desire to. So as I said before, it's a strange culture. It's Persian. It's at the court. It involves strange people, eunuchs. It involves a harem. And it involves a marriage in which the wife doesn't see her husband unless he calls her by name, as we'll see later on in the story. It's also a story of courage and of wit and of how God used Esther to save his people from the fate which Hitler himself intended many years later for the Jews. Part 1, how Esther became queen. The king had a queen, Vashti. He threw a large banquet that went on for weeks. At some point, to entertain everybody, he ordered Vashti to appear and dance for all of his guests. Vashti refused, and he said to his advisors, "What shall we do? The queen has refused my command." And they said, "Oh, this is bad. Everybody is going to hear that a wife can defy her husband and get away with it. And then wives all over Persia will be defying their husbands and getting away with it. You'd better depose her." So they talk him into deposing Vashti as queen, and now she's out. I will say, the advisors do get something. Leaders of society lead, and people follow their example. So they're right about that. Well, some days passed, and we come to the beginning of chapter 2, and we read that the king calms down and he begins to anchor after Vashti, whom he has deposed. The servants don't want her back in place, and so they divert the king's attention with a new scheme. They say to the king, "Here's what we'll do. We'll go throughout the whole kingdom. We'll round up the best-looking young women. We'll bring them here to the palace. You get to have one per night, and when you find one you really like, you choose the best one. She's the new queen." And you might say, what man wouldn't go for that scheme? Anyway, Ahasuerus goes with his scheme, and that's the plan. Mordecai gets introduced at this point. Mordecai and his first cousin, Esther, whom he has raised. Mordecai's brother is her father. Father and mother are both dead, so Mordecai has raised Esther. Mordecai is from the tribe of Benjamin. He is the great-grandson of one of the exiles that Nebuchadnezzar took into captivity, so you can date this sometime in the late 400 B.C., say 480, 470 B.C. What's the first thing we read about Esther? Well, it's the thing that's important for the starting of the story. She is beautiful. I'm interesting that our translation somewhat shies away from the clarity of the Hebrew. I looked up the old New American Standard Bible. I have it there in your bulletins. That's the more literal translation. What it says very plainly is, she was fair of form and beautiful. You know how to translate that into contemporary language. She had a gorgeous figure, and she had a really pretty face. That's Esther. Mordecai tells her, "Don't reveal that you're Jewish." Which tells us something right there. This is not Daniel. Daniel, you remember, and his three friends, they say, "Can't we please eat kosher?" and not eat the king's food. You remember that story from Daniel. And they take a courageous stand to do this. Mordecai is advising his ward, don't even let them know you're Jewish, which means she is not eating according to the Jewish dietary laws at all. There's no way to tell from her behavior that she's not part of the Persian Empire completely. One of the things I like to do when I preach to a passage is look up commentaries from other centuries than my own last two. I like to look at something from 300 years ago, from the Middle Ages, from the ancient world. So I often look at Matthew Henry to get kind of a late Puritan take on the passage. And I like Matthew Henry's comments about Esther at this point. Matthew Henry, if you want to know, writes about 1700 in England. You remember, England still has a court and a king that means something, not like today. And it's still very much a hierarchical society. All right, so here this is Matthew Henry on Esther. He writes, "She was a beauty, fair of form, good of countenance. Her wisdom and virtue were her greatest beauty." Now, I like that because there's no indication of that at this point in the passage. Later on, however, it is true. "Her wisdom and virtue were her greatest beauty. But it is an advantage of a diamond to be well set." Then, a further observation, which really actually staggered me. The Septuagint translators, this would be from a little before the birth of Christ into Greek from the Hebrew scriptures, the Septuagint translators say that Mordecai designed to make her his wife. If that were so, he was to be praised that he opposed not her better preferment. Do you understand what he's saying here? Mordecai planned to marry her, first cousin, but when something a lot better than that came along, namely being rounded up as part of the beauty pageant for the king, we should praise Mordecai for not opposing her bettering herself in life. No American would write that, would they? I'd be inclined to say, he is robbing her of any chance of true love. He is consigning her to imprisonment in a harem for the rest of her life. And the chances of her becoming queen, very small. And if she becomes queen, so what? Anyway, that's an Englishman in the 1700 on this passage. Different customs. Esther, like Daniel, gains favor with the guy in charge. He is a eunuch, and we have his name here several times. He's in charge of the king's women until they've been in to see the king, at which point a different eunuch is in charge of the king's women. He gains her favor. He gives her 7 choice maids. Do any of you have any idea what it's like to have even one maid? We had one maid in Cyprus when we were there in 1970, 2 days a week, half a day each day, drove my wife crazy. So I can't imagine life with 7 choice maids, but that's what she's got. And she got the best room in the palace that he had charge of. Mordecai, meanwhile, marches back and forth in front of the women's quarters. He is some sort of court official, we don't know what. And he watches for news and after her welfare. She can never come out again. That's part of the custom. So he's never going to see her face again as long as she lives, as long as he lives. He can send messages in. She can send messages out. They do that, but they don't see each other again. Nightly, women are taken to the king's bed, then on to the harem. They come to the king's bed again, only if he says, I remember Mary. I really liked Mary. Send Mary for me. Otherwise, they're done. Esther's turn comes. There's a special note here saying that she followed the advice of the chief eunuch. She didn't have her own ideas. She just followed his advice. I thought this was an interesting little note. I presume the chief eunuch knew what the king liked, and she had the wit to simply follow advice. A smart position for people who are starting out in something and don't know what they're doing. So you have something of her humility and wisdom here, just noted subtly in the text. Well, the upshot is, of all the women, we don't know their numbers, of all the women, Esther wins. The king loves her best of all. So, she's crowned Queen Esther. Vashti is gone. The king throws a feast of Esther. And now if you read through the rest of the book, what's Esther's actual position in the palace? It's not a marriage that any of us would recognize as a marriage. Although, she's the queen. She comes and goes at the king's whim. None of us run our marriages this way, do we? The wife stays in her room until we, from another room, say, I'd like to see you tonight. And otherwise, they are totally out of sight. That was who Esther was. She comes and goes at the king's whim. She is sheltered in the palace. Actually, she's imprisoned in the palace. She has as many servants as she wants to do whatever she wants to do for her. And she has no power in the affairs of state. The only way she might get power would be to have a son. And if the son became king, she might have power and influence as the queen mother. This has been true in lots of monarchies. By the way, Persian records indicate there's a Queen Esther who has a daughter, but no son. So we read nothing in this book about a son. And I'm impressed that as I read this book, there is no overt protest against the customs of the Persians. Just, this is how it is. All right, second part of the book. I'm going to call this Palace Plots, and there are two plots. The first plot. Two of the large bodyguard eunuchs get angry at the king and plot his murder. Mordecai overhears it, sends a message into Esther. Esther takes the message to the king. The king investigates, finds the allegations are true. These two guys are hanged. The king's life is saved. And the record is written in the chronicles of all the things that happened in the king's reign. This comes back again. Second plot. The king now advances a guy named Haman to the place of favorite. Now, again, we don't have a monarchy. The closest thing we have is a president. And the president's chief of staff is probably as close to the position of Haman as you could get. When a president is in serious trouble politically in this country, he will often sacrifice his chief of staff and fire him and get somebody else. And then the baying dogs quiet down for a while in the media. And if you've been around long enough, you've seen this process work. Kings used to deliberately, among all of the nobles in the land, pick one, make him the favorite, so that the envy that would ordinarily be headed at the king gets diverted onto the favorite. And once you've used the favorite long enough, and he's absorbed all the envy, and he's become really, really hated, then you give everybody satisfaction by cutting him down to size, you throw him out, and somebody else becomes the new favorite, right? Deliberate policy of kings in many times and places. So Haman's the favorite. And Haman is delighted to be the favorite. He has immense power and wealth, a lot of fame, and only one thing is really a burr under the saddle of Haman. When he walks out through the city and everybody bows down to him, have you ever had everybody bow down to you? I'm assuming it must be rather gratifying. I once was at an assembly at Upper Darby High School after I'd won the state meet in the high hurdles. And this was an assembly where they gave me an award in front of 800, 1,200 people for doing this. And I can still remember the long applause as I walked down to get this. And I remember at the time thinking, I can learn to enjoy this. This is not good. Haman loved to have everybody just bow down to him. And there was one guy who just wouldn't bow, and that was Mordecai. Now, we have no idea why Mordecai just decided to stick it to Haman, poor guy, stick it to Haman by refusing to bow, but Mordecai would just stand straight, sort of like a Quaker ahead of his time. The Quakers always refused to bow or take their hats off. We get a little hint of that at the American fury at Obama bowing to the Saudi king. We say, what do you think you're doing? You're an American. You don't bow to a king. All right, that's the American reaction to Obama. Well, Mordecai just refused to refused to bow. And Haman would just, Haman's got everything he wants. He's the favorite, he's powerful, he's rich, he's famous, and Mordecai won't bow to him. So Haman's complaining to his family, and they said, why don't you just kill him? Ah, that's not enough. So he finds out that Mordecai is Jewish, and he says, I will get my revenge on Mordecai by killing all the Jews of the entire empire. So he goes to the king, and he says to the king, you know, you've got a people in this empire that don't fit in. They're like from another place. They have their own customs. They have their own ways of doing things. They don't belong in the empire. We just need to cleanse the empire of these people who just don't fit in very well. And if we do this, I'll promise to give to the king this gigantic sum of money. Because kings, by the way, ordinarily don't like to kill off lots of their people because those people pay taxes. And that's why dictators are usually protectors of minorities. Saddam was better for the Christians in Iraq than his successors have been. Saddam gets it that you want people to pay taxes. So the king ordinarily doesn't want to kill off a bunch of his subjects because he doesn't want to lose their taxes. So Haman says, I'll pay you a huge sum of money. Of course, Haman's going to get it by looting their possessions. So the king lets himself be talked into this. He signs a declaration. Remember, one of the rules of the Medes and Persians was, you think the law through carefully, and then you don't change it. That was the idea. That's actually a good thing. You should plan, make your word, and then it sticks. So that was their rule. So Haman knew this. You get it signed, and the decree is out on such and such a date. You just kill all the Jews in the empire. Send it out to all the provinces. This is second palace plot. Third part of the story. Esther now finds why she's queen. Mordecai, when he heard this there in the capital city, dressed himself in sackcloth and ashes. Instantly, somebody brought word to Esther. Your cousin is dressed in sackcloth and ashes. Esther sent clothes out. Put some clothes on. He refuses. So she sends out her chief of staff, so to speak, her chief of staff, the eunuch Hathach. Find out what the trouble is. Mordecai talks to him. He's a responsible man. He sends back the decree with this instruction from Mordecai. Go to the king. Esther sends back and says, I cannot just up and go to the king even though I am the queen. If I go to the king and I appear in his throne room and he hasn't called me, the ordinary rule is I get put to death. Nobody dares to just go and show up and see the king. You go at invitation only. Only if I go and he sees me and he thinks, I didn't invite her, but let's see what she wants. I love her. And he holds out the scepter that shows he's king in his hand like this to me. Only then do I live. This is not such an easy thing. You ask Mordecai to just go in and talk to the king about this. And it's been 30 days since he called me. And here you get a picture of a marriage that's not like any marriages we're used to. 30 days since he's seen her, and she's afraid to go. Mordecai sends back this message to Esther. He said, answer Esther this way. This is from chapter 4. Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? For who knows that you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? So Esther listens to her cousin Mordecai, who raised her, and she says, all right, you go tell him. Get the Jews in Shushan together. Tell them to fast for 3 days and pray. And then I will go into the king. And if I die, I die. So Mordecai gathers the Jews together. They pray. They fast for 3 days. Esther's not fasting. She's plotting. It's a good thing. She's using her wit. She's planning how she's going to approach the king. She prepares a huge banquet and decides how she'll handle things. At the end of 3 days, she puts on her royal robes. She goes to the throne room. If you just imagine an unimaginably large room, think of one of the museums in the city, for example, that you may have been at with really high hall ceilings and marble floors, just not like anybody's living room, right? She's not going to the living room, right? So she goes and she stands where the king can see her. And if the king does not, in a fairly short period of time, extend the scepter, his servants will simply take her and execute her. She was not invited. So the king sees her, she stands there trembling, and the king extends his scepter. We've got the customs well accounted here. Esther then steps forward, touches the top of the scepter, kneels before the king. And of course, she went to the king only if he wanted something. So she's not there just to chat. No, so he doesn't say, "So what would you like to talk about today, Esther?" The king says, "What would you like? Even to the half of my kingdom, you may have it." Now you see Esther's wit. Esther says, "All I would like would be to have you come to a banquet that I've prepared for you today." She's counting on the fact that he hasn't seen her for 30 days. And he loves her. And just come to the banquet I've prepared for you. Here is a thoughtful wife. She's been separated for 30 days from her husband. And so she prepares a great banquet for him. She doesn't cook it. She's got all these servants. But great banquet. And then she adds in kind of an offhand way, "And bring Haman along with you." So the king and the Haman, they go to the banquet. King is curious. Something is up. "All right, Esther, tell me, what can I do for you?" Nothing like postponing an answer to arouse curiosity and close attention from the king. And so Esther says to the king, "All I ask is that you come to another banquet tomorrow, just like this one, and then I will tell you." So the king goes back to his quarters, to a sleepless night, as we'll see in a moment. Maybe he ate too much food. To a sleepless night, Haman goes home, and Haman is just bursting with pride. He says to his wife, and to his relatives, and to his children, he says, "Let me tell you where I was today. I was at a banquet from Queen Esther. And the only ones she wanted there were the king and me." How could life be going better for Haman? And his wife and his family says, "You are a great man." He says, "But you know what? There's one thing that still grates on me. Mordecai still won't bow to me." So his family makes a helpful suggestion. "Well, why don't you build a 75-foot-high gallows in the backyard here?" And actually, backyard is anachronistic. It would be inside his walls. Right? That's where it would be. Inside his walls and his palace compound. And when the day comes that we get to kill all the Jews, you can bring Mordecai here and hang him on your gallows. Haman says, "Great idea." Calls the carpenters and they put up the gallows. And now you have something that you also have in the book of Ruth. There's a very restrained way in which this book is written. It's written in this form, "And it happened, and it happened, and it happened." Right? We don't even read the name of God in this book. There's no, "And God planned this, and God planned that." There's no prophet behind this book that knows the mind of God the way the prophets did. So we have simply, "And it happened." So we have, "And it happened that night that the king could not sleep." So the king, I suppose, thought of the most boring thing he could think of to help him go to sleep, which was an endless chronicle of all the events of his reign. So he says to his servant, "Go bring the chronicles of all the things that have happened while I've been king and read them to me." So they start reading them to him. "On this date, this happened. On this date, this happened." It's like the diary of the kingdom. It doesn't work. He doesn't go to sleep. Morning is beginning to break. And he comes to the story where he tells about Mordecai uncovering the plot of these two guys who are going to assassinate him. And the king suddenly says, "Did we ever do anything for Mordecai?" "Nope, nothing ever done for Mordecai." "I need an idea of something to do." "Who's out there in the outer courts?" Somebody says, "Oh, Haman just came into work."
All right, call Haman in. So he brings in Haman. Haman, says the king, what should be done to the man whom the king desires to honor? Now, who do you suppose Haman thinks the king's talking about? Haman. And so Haman comes up with what Haman would love most of all. He says, well, how about you put on this man a robe that the king has worn, and put him on a horse that the king has ridden, and give him some public relations guys to come in front of him and shout throughout the city, thus it shall be done for the man whom the king desires to honor. And then lead him around the city on the horse so that everybody knows this man is honored by the king. And the king says to Haman, that is a good idea. Go do that for Mordecai. Now you get an idea of the empire. You know, this was an empire where if the king said to you, jump, what you said was, how high? So Haman goes off and gathers the robe and the horse and the servants and Mordecai and puts Mordecai on the horse, Mordecai who won't bow to him, and leads him through the city himself. And then he goes home and he tells his wife and children of the awful, most humiliating experience of his entire life. And I've always loved this. You know, you have another marriage here in the book. You've got Haman and his wife. She says to him, oh, that's a bad omen. I think Mordecai is going to get the best of you in the end, you know? And with that cheerful note from his wife, the messengers arrive and say, time to go to the queen's second banquet. So Haman goes off to the queen's second banquet, just the queen, Haman, and the king. And now the king says, and he is full of curiosity, he wants to know now, he really wants to know. He says, Esther, what can I do for you? What do you want? And listen to Esther's answer. Then Queen Esther answered and said, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss. I want my life. I want the life of my people. Even if you just said, we'll sell you all as slaves, I'd have kept quiet. But now, how can the king ever be compensated for his loss? Notice how carefully prepared this statement is. Notice the appeal to the king's interest in taxes in the last comment. The king was furious. He went out into the garden to simply absorb what he had heard. Haman stayed behind to plead for his life, and he fell on the couch where the queen sat. The king returned, saw Haman on the queen's couch, and shouted, he's now even assaulting the queen. Which, of course, he wasn't. And at these words, the servants helpfully just covered Haman's face, because Haman is a dead man. And then one of the eunuchs helpfully notes that Haman built a gallows for Mordecai, who the king just remembered that morning had saved his life from a plot. And so the king says, hang Haman on it. Last part of the book is how things turn out. The king can't reverse his decree. But what he does do is issue another decree, a right of defense to the Jews throughout the kingdom. And he makes plain now where he stands. He's on the side of the Jews. So when the day comes, the Jews gather to protect themselves. They killed some of their enemies in the provinces and in Shushan. In Shushan, the fighting went on for 2 days. And then Mordecai, and we haven't talked much about him, but he was some sort of court official. The king now makes Mordecai his new favorite. He takes the place of Haman and rules the empire in the king's stead the way Joseph ruled in Egypt for Pharaoh's stead. Mordecai decreed the Feast of Purim, which comes in March to the present day. If you have Jewish friends, they will still celebrate the Feast of Purim with Hamantasha. How many of you have heard of Hamantasha? Okay. Hamantasha, three-cornered hats that probably go all the way back to the ancient Persian world. That would be the hat that Haman would have worn, style of those days. Pastries, they eat them. They recite the book of Esther on the Feast of Purim. They give gifts to the poor, and they feast. What to say about this book? Well, a couple of things. You know, the Bible says God has those in every place who love and serve him. And Christians from one social status sometimes look at certain parts of our culture and think there can't be any Christians there. I think we are almost certainly mistaken. Let me give an example like this from the history of Israel. You remember Ahab, the worst king Israel ever had, with his wife Jezebel, set out to kill all of the prophets of the Lord. Killed many. What he didn't know was his chief of staff, Obadiah, took 50 prophets and hid them in this cave and fed them, and took 50 more prophets and hid them in that cave and fed them. And so out of the king's taxes and income, Obadiah was still saving 100 of the Lord's prophets. I don't think Ahab ever knew this. Obadiah did. And Obadiah secretly served the Lord. And I can imagine if you were a servant of God in Israel in those days, and you looked at the palace, and you saw Ahab and his wickedness, and Jezebel and her wickedness, and you saw Obadiah, you'd be tempted to say, why is Obadiah working for that wicked man? Why doesn't he show some integrity and quit? And you'd never know that Obadiah is doing this good thing, because if people knew about it, it would be stopped. Obadiah is a hero. And when he finally meets Elijah, and Elijah says, go tell the king I've appeared, Obadiah says to Elijah, don't you know what I've done? It's possible Elijah doesn't know what he's done. We should thank God for such people. Christians are sometimes too quick to judge what is a life with integrity and service of God and what is not. Especially if we're not at the heights of society, we may look that direction and be judgmental in an ignorant and foolish way. I can imagine Jews in Persia saying, what is Esther think she's doing, and what did Mordecai think he's doing? But she was there by God's plan at the right time to save Israel from its greatest danger until 1942. I think we should pray for such people. We may not even know their names. Thank God for them. Theirs is a lonely and misunderstood position in life and society. Second thing, there is an obvious calling here from God to serve him in whatever place we find ourselves, with all the wit and courage we can muster. You know, Esther could have just blundered into the king and delivered her message, and she might well have failed. It is by planning, foresight, and clever wit that she makes it most probable that the king will hear her complaint. That is how to think as we try to do good in our lives. This is true in our families, our churches, our marriages, our neighborhoods, our work, our school, our country. And the last thing is, I want you to notice Mordecai's faith. If you choose not to act, deliverance will arise for the Jews from some other quarter. We Christians never despair. We Christians never despair. I think if we were to know Christians in North Korea, we would find them, and I'm sure there are some there, we would find them not despairing people, but people full of hope, because the Lord reigns. Because the Lord reigns, he will so make it happen. He will so overrule in the affairs of men that in the end, evil does not prosper, however good it looks, however promising its prospects look for a time. Evil will not prosper. The communist government of Russia has fallen. Those of you younger don't quite get what that means to people my age. It will so happen to all who oppose the God of heaven Their time will be only brief. So Christians, never despair. Jesus said, "All authority is given unto me in heaven and on earth. Go therefore and live your lives." Not exactly the way he said it, but I think that's the command to all Christians. Go therefore and teach all nations and live your lives in hope and confidence that the Lord reigns. Amen.